Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Hi there, Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience and also founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So sometimes for many of us just reading the news or watching the news, it feels that these might be the worst of times. It feels that the country is in a middle of a civil war, that the government is dysfunctional, that many of our institutions are not working, that the reds and the blues are fighting and will be fighting forever, and that there's a lot of discontent and unhappiness all around the country. And certainly much of our coverage doesn't move much beyond Washington, D.C. So this is where our images are formed. But today we have with us James Fallows to discuss a new book that he and his wife, Deborah, have just published, Our Towns, 100,000-Mile Journey into the Heart of America, which, as we'll discuss, presents a very different vision and picture of what's going on around the country in different towns and cities. Our guest, James Fallows, has been a national correspondent for The Atlantic for over 34 years now, and he's reported from all over the world. He's written 11 books. He's published in many outlets. He's the recipient of a National Book Award and a National Magazine Award. And he was also a speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter for 2 years. And he wrote the book with his wife, Deborah Fallows, who's a linguist and writer with a PhD in theoretical linguistics. She has written 2 books. She's also published extensively The Atlantic, National Geographic, Slate, The New York Times, and more. So, Jim, welcome to our show.
Julian, thanks so much. It's a real pleasure. I'm a big fan and devotee of your and Sam's analyses, so I'm really glad to be part of the parade here.
Thanks so much. Maybe we can start by just having you explain to our listeners the origins of the book and the way in which you traveled across the country to put these stories together.
Good. I think there were two confluences that came together about 4 or 5 years ago in our thinking, in Deb and my thinking, we wanted to do this. One is, through our whole life, we've done things like this. As you mentioned, I worked for The Atlantic for a long time, and over those years, we've spent about half the time based in D.C. and the other half other places. We lived in Japan and Malaysia for about 4 years. We lived in China for a total of almost 4 years. We were based in Seattle and Berkeley and in Texas for a number of years, and we really have liked just getting out on the road and seeing what do you not know about a place until you go into the hinterlands. So we wanted to extend that in the U.S. The other was, we came back from China most recently in 2011, where the news in China for the recent years had been of America just entirely falling apart during the economic troubles. And so we wanted to say, again, how would we compare what it looked like in the interior of the U.S. with what we had seen in the preceding years in China, where they had big economic blows, but then they were coming back. The way that was one kind of source of confluence. The other was, for a number of decades, I've been an avid small plane pilot. And we had a small airplane, propeller-driven plane called a Cirrus SR-22, and we had previously been all across the country to little airports and knew how different the perspective was from these places you might not otherwise go on interstates, or certainly on normal airlines, to Grand Island, Nebraska, or Red Oak, Iowa, or Rock Springs, Wyoming. So we thought, let's do sort of systematically, knowing we have this medium/gimmick of the plane, a little flying car.
Charlie.
Yes, it was sort of the flying Charlie, but with weight and balance problems that Steinbeck didn't have in travels with Charlie. Let's see if we can look more, if there's a way to have this be the vision of the country. Also, I just like it. And so we put out a post 5 years ago almost in the Atlantic site saying, tell us about your town and a smaller place that's had some kind of problem and how they have dealt with it and why that town's story matters. And we got like 1,000 replies. So we've essentially been working through that list ever since.
And so it was over a course of 5 years that you were putting this together. Is this a static period when you go to these towns, or within the time that you wrote the book and did the research, were things changing, you know, dramatically or subtly in the different places that you went?
That's been on our mind, as you can imagine, because, you know, the first serious traveling we did was back in the just about 5 years ago now. We went to the upper Midwest, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Holland, Michigan, and Rapid City, South Dakota. And there are places that, you know, everything in life changes over 4 or 5 years. Some of the town, some of the businesses we've wrote about, one or two of them have gotten in business trouble. One of them closed. Several more have grown. One of the mayors we focused on is now in legal trouble, et cetera. But I guess that the couple big secular changes that have been going on, the country as a whole over the past 5 years has been having what we all know of as too slow growth, but still growth. It's been improving rather than collapsing, but at a slow rate. So that's been one background force. A second background force is, of course, the buildup to the politics of the past 2 years. And I guess a third background force has been something that we saw in early stages. I think a downtown revolution of having a next generation of people think they wanted to consider living not the suburban dream, but the downtown dream, and considering it in some smaller cities, that's been gathering momentum. So we've been relieved as we spent much of last year writing the book. We tried to catch up with people we'd seen before and say, well, what about this you told us? I would say sort of in a 80-20 balance, about 80% of them, things were moving along and were positive extrapolations of what we had seen. 20% had run into new problems. But we have tried to keep up with them.
And then one town that the chapter really thought was fascinating was Holland, Michigan. You know, which gets us into part of the country we hear about. It certainly was a big state in terms of national politics. What's going on in Holland, Michigan? What did you find?
Well, the story of Holland, Michigan, as your astute listeners will not be surprised to hear, was originally settled by Dutch people, and it sort of makes a point out of its kitschy Dutchness. They have tulip festivals and they have windmills all over the place. I don't any of your listeners who've spent time in Holland, as I have, recognize the feeling. I'm you know, in my good days, I'm nearly 6'2", but in Holland, I'm a short guy, Holland the country. And in Holland, Michigan, there's some of the same thing, too, where there are all these, you know, Dutch people are big. And so that there is that heritage, Dutch and manufacturing oriented, that all of the, you know, huge part of the wealth of the town had come from manufacturing, whether it was in woodworking or furniture making as part of greater Grand Rapids or in auto supply, et cetera. So it had a strong manufacturing heritage, a distinct ethnic identity, and a very, very distinct politically conservative caste, where the DeVos family is from there. And they're one of the big sort of local titans. The Amway company is based there. It is a really, really conservative thing. Eric Prince, the security company guy is from there. And so what's happening now that's dramatic is two or three tensions. One is manufacturing in general under stress. How have they dealt with that? And the answer is pretty well through these agile repositionings. A more dramatic change is the town is now just about majority Latino. So you have this just barely 50-50 of essentially white, conservative, Christian, Dutch descendants, and then just about the same number of mainly Latino people, mainly Catholics, who've come up for the agriculture industries or other things, and how they have been able to work with that. And then the general pressure on the upper Midwest, that Holland is a really snowy place. It's beautiful, but they get like 10 feet of snow a year. So the ways in which they've tried to navigate these various conflicts has been fascinating and largely successful. I'll give you one illustration of the snow. One of their local business people decided that Holland would be better if it weren't snowbound. So he put up something like, $250,000, something of his own money, for a snow melt project where they took waste heat from the city-owned power plant and ran it in little plastic pipes underneath the streets and the sidewalks of a big part of downtown and just heated the downtown through the whole winter. So Holland had 10 feet of snow, but none of it on its actual sidewalks or streets, which was part of a downtown renaissance that now has some momentum. So you could have a little microcosm.
Is that waste heat?
Yes, it's just waste heat.
I see.
So this is a positive, this is a good rather than extra burden solution that they came up with. So it's if you want to have an oddly charming microcosm of almost every tension you're thinking of, and one other point that the city which probably most of the a huge majority of the taxpaying citizens don't send their children to public school for a combination of white flight reasons and religious school reasons, but they have passed a big school bond issue for a largely Latino school population, just saying that, you know, we need to support our own, and these people are now our own, and we have to take care of them.
Do Latinos get along with, I'm having this picture of whites in the shrinking majority and Betsy DeVos being kind of a poster child for them, and then this growing Latino community. Do these two communities get along? Are they aligned about how they see the world, how they see their community?
So I would not presume. We were there for a total of maybe 2 weeks, which was a typical stay of most places that we wrote about, and I would not presume to have had detailed knowledge on that point. What I will say is that there were a whole lot of places we went where ethnic change was a theme. That was the same thing in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, also Allentown.
Oh, good.
PA.
I want to talk about Sioux Falls.
And so in all these places, obviously we asked people in the different communities, how is this changing now that you're going from being upper Midwest, Scandinavian, Germanic, white, to having this usually Latino, but also African and other presence that was there? And usually there was a big gap between how people would think about that issue on a national level, which is voting for Trump, and how they would think about it locally, which was, well, of course, we need to have our school system work because these people are going to be a part of our community in the future, and we need to all rise together. And we saw very little evidence, even while asking people in all the communities, of, you know, the sort of white-hot friction you might associate with Northern Ireland back in the old days, or other multi-ethnic, say, South Boston, also back in the old days. Generally, I think if you didn't know about the tone of national politics, you would think the local tone is like what Americans would like to expect, which is not perfect, but gradually positive interaction among different groups.
That's interesting, because if we think about how we perceive national politics, I have been wondering about this for some time, that national politics has an abstract quality where it's hard to know whether voting for Trump is going to affect your personal well-being in a positive or negative way. It's hard to see these effects, especially since any action, even the most extreme actions at a federal level, get filtered through multiple levels of regulation, local government, and so on. And so it makes me think that national politics is sort of this abstract game that people play where, you know, we may care a lot about how things turn out, but at the same time, it's hard to know what pulling the lever is going to do, except that, you know, your neighbors like it, so you should probably like it too, as opposed to these local things like school boards and so on.
You know, I agree entirely with that. And I've been struggling over the last couple of years to find the right metaphor for this game of national politics, where it's become a signaling thing. You know, we know that we hate Hillary, therefore we're going to really have all these Trump signs in our lawn. I think that the tribalism of the anti-Hillary movement and identity was really palpable to us through 2016. It's like religious differences, where you might not know what religion somebody is until you ask. Once you find out in a polarized society, then you're either their friend or their enemy. But it is, as you say, disconnected in time. And again, we saw, you know, people in Wyoming, they went for Trump by 2-1, simultaneously hoping he wouldn't disrupt NAFTA, that he wouldn't disrupt immigration, that he wouldn't do, you know, they were in favor of his coal regulation, but everything else, the abstract symbolism of being for Trump was at odds with all the practical consequences they wanted to see in their local existence.
Well, people who are serious about politics cringe a little bit when I say this, but it's a little bit, you know, like if you're from Boston, who you're rooting for? Anybody who's playing the Yankees, that's who you're rooting for. And so I think that professional sports has a lot of the, you know, sports fans have a lot of the same vibe. And, you know, I know that politics is serious. It affects our lives. But come on, if I pull the lever for Hillary Clinton, how much does that affect my life? It's hard to know.
So I am so relieved, as just a kind of non-credentialed journalist, to hear actual respectable and prestigious Ivy League professors using the sports analogy, because that has occurred to me too. It's the Red Sox and the Yankees. It's anybody against the Patriots. It's USC, UCLA. It's any other great cleavage you want to think of. So, yes, thank you.
So as turning to journalism, I mean, one of the great things about the book is there's all these big issues like polarization that you were just discussing, education, race, the press, that, and you can, I mean, when you read the stories of actual towns and actual people, you see some of the nuances and complexities of what's actually playing out around the country. And I caught, you have a great chapter on Burlington, Vermont. And at the end, you talk about this newspaper, 7 Days, which goes against the grain of what we know is happening with local journalism. Can you tell us a little bit about this paper?
Yes. And so it certainly is the case that journalism, the business model of journalism worldwide and nationwide, is under a lot of stress, and that nowhere more so than in local newspapers in general. And so I don't want, you know, what we saw reinforced the idea that local journalism matters, and it's in economic trouble, and that needs to be high in our attention list for engagement. But we kept finding interesting cases that had bucked that trend, and one was the 7 Days former Alt Weekly in Burlington, which is you feel as you've transported back in time, because you know, when I started out in journalism back in the 70s, there were all these Alt Weeklies, City Paper in D.C. and others, that were great big fat print things on the model of the Village Voice in New York. And 7 Days still has that effect, and it is fat with help wanted ads and other kinds of local ads. Vermont is a coherent enough sort of statewide market that they can treat it almost as a whole market. And the editors and publishers there are saying that what seemed to be their source of success is they made people feel better about being in Vermont, by which I don't mean happy talk or saying, oh, aren't we living up here in this remote kingdom, but rather some sense of active connection to the entertainment that was there, but also the challenges. They've done a whole lot of coverage on opioids, you know, which is a huge problem in Vermont, and 7 Days has been very good in covering it. They've just, you know, they feel as if making the fact of living with an identity as a Vermonter and a Burlington person, they cultivated that and had a kind of local patriotism and local consciousness, which had a positive feedback loop and made them, as of the last time I talked to them a couple of months ago, still doing very well, both commercially and culturally.
And then you have another really great section on Greenville, South Carolina, and you're comparing it to Burlington. And you say in principle, you would compare Greenville and the upstate with Burlington and northern Vermont, only to highlight the unbridgeable chasms in American politics. One of the most right-leaning regions versus one of the most left-leaning. But then you say, if you looked at Burlington and Greenville as cities for their amenities and feel and civic sense and for the history of public-private interactions behind today's cityscapes, you would find more similarities than you might expect. And you talk about the waterfront, you talk about the shopping, the cultural and the recreational life. You talk about minor league baseball. Can you tell us a little bit about what the two of you were thinking as you made this comparison and you saw those similarities? How are these areas alike?
So the process of coming to that conclusion or that intuition, it was with each city we went to, we'd spent time on for the first half dozen of them, this was all just new. But after that, we started saying, oh, yeah, this park in Greenville looks just like that one we remember from Sioux Falls and down a long list. And this became really pronounced because within a relatively compact period of time, a couple months, we had repeated visits both to Burlington and to Greenville. Many of your listeners are probably more familiar with Burlington than Greenville, I would guess, but who knows. But Burlington is famous as this sort of this era's Berkeley from the 60s or 70s, where you know, Bernie Sanders was the mayor there, and usually the political tension is the Democrats against the socialists, and it has the leading sustainability movement, et cetera. And Greenville is the home of Bob Jones University, and it is the home of Trey Gowdy and before him Jim DeMint. And it's usually in the news only during the South Carolina Republican primary of just seeing how far right the South Carolina Republicans are going to go. But it's, again, if you didn't know that and you had mix and match, I made the point, which may have sort of offended the mayors of each town, that they really were separated at birth. They have beautiful high-end downtown, not high-end, beautiful fully realized downtowns now, with lots of, you know, active pedestrian walking streets, and with downtown residential, and with startups moving downtown, and craft breweries, and just all the other things that make a downtown functional now. They have public spaces that are obviously enjoyable for people. We were in Greenville about 2 weeks ago again, and the so-called Swamp Rabbit Trail was just crammed with people, all ages, all races, just out, you know, walking around on a typically nice day in a cold spring. Burlington has its waterfront and everything. And the path by which they got to these destinations in both cases involved a very careful and non-contentious interaction among private companies, both established and startup, among universities, the state government, the city government, ways they could sort of cadge support out of the national government. And so if you were doing case studies of sort of the path-dependent route to success, and you had Burlington and Greenville, you would put them in the same category rather than the opposite extremes, which are the ones they normally occupy in our political diagram.
This sounds like a kind of Clintonian public private partnership. I'm thinking back to something that Deb noted early on, actually quite early on. She at least that's where you put it in the book, the idea of a river walk with or without a river.
Yeah, it is true. I mean, this will be a challenge for my own hometown of Redlands, California, very near yours,
yes,
Sam, I believe.
Yes, I'm from Riverside, and these are dusty places.
Yes, and Riverside, ironically, despite its name, has no visible river, although the Santa Ana River was once visible and still is during floods. But Redlands doesn't even have that. But they're having a beautiful, I guess if they had more... more sense of whimsy, they would call it a river walk too, even though it's along the mountain trails. But yes, the idea of finding ways to have these deliberately creating public spaces for public good, and that actually seems to work, and people like it, and they show up, and it makes them think of the town and spend more time downtown.
Well, I always used to think about these things as when I travel to a place, either driving cross country, you know, I didn't have the adventure or the abilities to fly cross country. And by the way, does your plane have a name?
It has. The short answer is they have numbers. So
right.
We've had through the stages of this. So it doesn't have a name. And, you know, we wish we had a name like Rosinante from
exactly.
John Steinbeck.
Right, from the Steinbeck book.
But that would be uppity on our part. So we're just going. So the plane we had, it was 435 Sierra Romeo, a Cirrus SR-22.
Yes, romantic. But I mean, going to, you know, in my own version of it when I was younger, driving cross country, here you and Deborah Fallows flying cross country, you have the river walk, and there are other sentinel, let's what an ecologist would call sentinel species, things that show up in town after town that struck you as signs of thriving. Another one is microbreweries.
Yes. And, you know, this sounds preposterous, I know, but I contend it's actually a thing. And I you know, look for these because I'm a big craft brew guy, and I have written about Jim Cook of Sam Adams over the years. And actually, history will record that Jimmy Carter, for whom I worked long ago, one of the things he did was to make the craft brewing revolution possible, because he deregulated home brewing, and everybody will say Jimmy Carter was the father of the craft beer revolution. But it is a real thing now, as I'm sure you all are aware. On the national level, it's become a non-trivial job creator, that there's something in the hundreds of thousands of jobs that are directly or indirectly related to craft brewing. Also, you can see what it does in a city, because they appear at a certain point where if a city is beginning to recover, some craft brewer will set up some operation out on the fringe of town precisely because they need cheap real estate for all the stuff, all the brewing equipment they have. And that then has a magnet effect. We were in Duluth just last week, where a brewery called Bent Paddle has become the poster child of that. There was a very old, declining former steel yard
area. And you went there first in 2014.
Yeah, so actually I went there first in 1999.
Oh, okay, right. But I mean for this book.
Yeah, for this book in 2014. We've been back and forth there a lot. The reason I've been there so often is that it's where our Cirrus airplanes are from. So I got one of the very first ones back in 99, and so we've been back and forth to Duluth, where at the end of April there was ice all over the nose of Lake Superior. But Bent Paddle has its side of town, which had been really, anybody would recognize it as a hard-pressed down and out side of town. It is beginning the commercial rebirth of that side of town because there's a reason for people to come there now, and then other businesses arise around it.
I want to focus a little bit south of Duluth, partly because this is sort of self-interested. I've never been there, and my former student, Alex, is a professor at Augustana University in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So I want to get into a little bit because I think it's got some themes in here. This genius of America. I think of South Sioux Falls as being a pretty white place. I don't think of it as a place that I would really kind of go through very often. But, you know, Alex loves this place, my student, and you write about the ethnic diversity and, I don't know, Muslims working in slaughterhouses. I kind of want to hear what is it like being in this town that people are actually quite proud of and where there are all these different communities living together. Talk about, let's see, you know, for instance, there's this woman who shops for groceries, a former refugee. Do you remember her?
So I think she would have been one of Deb's clients there. And Sue, I don't remember her as vividly as I remember a lot of other people, like the ROTC student who wore a hijab and the people working in the slaughterhouses. And so the Sioux Falls was the first place we spent a substantial amount of time that we had known nothing about before. And it was a genuine surprise for the reasons you say. And a confession that to me I now am completely ashamed of, but it was actually the truth 5 years ago, is I couldn't have confidently told you the difference between Sioux Falls and Sioux City. Now it's like Paris versus, you know, Beijing. Of course, how could you ever confuse them? Sioux Falls in the biggest city of South Dakota and Sioux City down the river in Iowa. And what makes Sioux Falls fascinating, I think, is that if people referred to it in national discourse, it would seem to symbolize a place that's out there someplace, somewhere. Within the Upper Plains, it's the place people come to. And
They
want to go to the big town that is not too big, that has something we heard again and again in Sioux Falls and elsewhere, is a place that was the right size, big enough to do the top end of almost anything you wanted, from medical care to universities to law practice to entertainment, but then of a size where you could drive any place in 10 minutes and where the cost of living was dramatically lower than it was in the handful of big coastal cities. And so this idea of the right size of town that people could feel involved in, we first heard in Sioux Falls, and it has a couple of other extraordinary things that I'd known nothing about. For example, there's a federally sponsored research center about 10 miles north of town that's attracted scientists from around the world called EROS. I forget what it's what it stands for, but essentially, it's the repository for all satellite imagery the U.S. has ever collected, and nearly everything that comes out of Google Maps or other things, or Google Earth, or anything you see that's a satellite image, comes from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. That's where it lives in that area. Most financial centers relocated there about in the 1980s during the credit card boom. There was a time when if you were paying Citibank or some other credit card, the mailing address would be Sioux Falls, South Dakota, because they calculated that the overall mailing time from mail deposited in the United States as a whole, overall it would get to Sioux Falls quicker than it would any place else, including from, you know, New York to a post office in New York. And because they had, you know, really good mail and communication systems, their workforce was polite sounding, et cetera. And that was a way in which they became a financial center. And then, just to give you the sort of short version, in the last 25 years, this basically white area where the main divides had been German Lutherans and Scandinavian Lutherans, which had really bitter disagreements among themselves, plus, of course, the tribal population of South Dakota, which is significant and has the challenges of tribes across the country. They became, over the last 25 years, a significant refugee center. And so you see lots of Somalis, lots of Sudanese, Burmese, Nepalese, largely working in the meatpacking industry. And you see all sorts of the saga of American ethnic succession there, where people working in the pig slaughterhouse, which is owned by a Chinese firm. It's a whole different story. They are largely Islamic refugees, largely women, who are working in these very difficult Upton Sinclair-type jobs, so that their children can go to Sioux Falls High School and be the head of Sioux Falls ROTC and to be in the science club in Sioux Falls ROTC and go on to either local universities at Augustana or around the world. So it is that part of the American drama is playing out in this town of Sioux Falls.
You betches.
But certainly, I mean, the great thing about this book is it will leave many readers with a very good feeling about some of what's going on economically and politically and socially. But certainly you must have also come across some of these fault lines that we're always watching and thinking about, for example, race. Did you encounter in some of the towns the kinds of divisions that we know are obviously important and relevant in our society?
Sure. And I think the leitmotif of our book is that everything you know about the challenges of America in general and in this era is true. That the great challenge of America through its history has been the legacy of slavery. And that the challenge of recent times, right at this moment, is opioids. And the challenge of the last generation is economic inequalities. And all those things are true. And to us, the surprise value was everything pushing in the other direction and seeing how these tensions work out. So I'll give you some illustrations of places where the axis was more visible in terms of ethnic, racial, and other cleavages. One, of course, would be San Bernardino, which Sam and I both know as the third town of the Inland Empire, his Riverside, my Redlands, and San Bernardino, which is by far the most troubled town in California and arguably the most in the United States, where they've had real governance problems and a variety of economic bad luck that I won't go into. But it's a very heavily non-white town, Latinos, blacks. I think the white population is maybe 25% or so, and Latinos the majority group, and then blacks. And they're part of it has had among its problems has been those of other largely minority towns around the country. But so finding ways to have economic and race equity in San Bernardino has been high on their list of challenges. When we spent time in northeastern Mississippi in the so-called Golden Triangle of Mississippi, a term I had not heard before but now know by heart, there, of course, everything is about the ongoing legacy of slavery. And their approach, while on the one hand having police episodes like every place else and having electoral divisions like every place else, has been in Columbus in particular, Mississippi, to embrace this as a central part of their identity. This wonderful school there called the Mississippi School for Math and Science, which is a publicly supported boarding high school for students from around the state, they put on these sort of nonstop series of pageants about the racial heritage of Mississippi, and they reenact street scenes from the slavery era and the Reconstruction era and all the other eras, and Erie, Pennsylvania. That was, in a way, the most Erie was recently ranked as being among the most challenging for black citizens of maybe any city anywhere, which is because largely of school district gerrymandering. Pennsylvania has a really cruel school funding system that has worked very badly to Erie's disadvantage. So almost any place we went, the underlying racial and economic divisions were part of the landscape, and sort of the challenge was in what ways were people either trying to ignore that or to work with it.
Let me turn to a very different kind of question. It was just interesting reading your book, how you knew what to look at. I mean, you have been a journalist for a long time now, written so many great things. And it struck me when I'm a swimmer, I've seen Redlands, California, you talk about pools, public pools, and how public pools can open up a lot to understanding a town. Can you talk about pools?
Yes, I will. So my wife, Deb.
How do you put your eye on something like that as a way into a small community?
So I'll channel for a moment my wife, Deb, who has, if she had her way, she would spend most of her waking hours swimming. She's a very good swimmer. She is routinely churning past people in the pool who are half her age, and she loves doing this. And this became her healthier version of my craft beer obsession and my airport obsession of saying this is a – she knew from her past life that this was an important public institution. So city by city, she would – one of the first things she would look for was the pool. Usually it was a YMCA. Sometimes it was just a public pool. Often it was a high school or something that had time that was open. And it was a way to have a structured reason to go to the YMCA and to see who you found there. Two institutions that might be considered generally antique, public libraries and YMCAs, we spent a lot of time in and found that both of them in different ways having really resonant effects. So Deb would use the YMCA and her daily experience there as a way of meeting people and seeing them. The way that we would as a team try to say what is interesting about this place would be a meta concept and then a practical measure. The meta concept is that I think of reporting as the process of what you didn't know until you got there. And so just what is it like to see Allentown, Pennsylvania now, or Erie, or Greenville, South Carolina, or Malta, Montana, or these other places. So just being alert to what you didn't expect, and therefore your readers might not expect too. And the other is just procedurally, we had a routine in the first two or three days we were at a place of just going through a list of usual suspects, the newspaper editor, the mayor, if there was one, the head of the library, the head of the school system, and say, what's interesting here? What's the story of the town? What don't people understand about your town? What are the big issues here? What do people talk about? Who makes things run here? And from that, we'd have the list of the next five people to talk to. And after we had talked to those five, we had a list of 200. And we'd eventually say, we need to spend the next 6 years here. But we would end up having spoken with a couple dozen people in each place. But it was a sort of feeling your way as you go, asking people, what's interesting? What don't people understand? What are the big questions? What's the story of the town?
So there you are doing your sleuthing, going through the communities, talking to person. I want to maybe we're kind of nearing the end here, and I want to bring some of these some of the sleuthing that you did to an area that's well known to our researchers. Sophie Helmers is an undergraduate who works with a lot. She's a force behind the scenes on politics and polls, and she's very interested. And you know, we've been talking about Greenville a lot, but I wanted to do it one more time. So Greenville, South Carolina, and both in your book and also in your Atlantic article, The Reinvention of America, which you know is about these themes. You contrast Greenville and Spartanburg, South Carolina. These are two cities near each other. They are served by a common airport, but they have very different outcomes. So here you are, you and Deb, nosing around on the ground, talking to people, feeling out local governments and businesses. What's the cause of the difference? These are two communities that seem to have somewhat different outcomes. Can you talk about what the source of that is?
Yes. The general fascination for us was pairs of cities, you know, Burlington versus Plattsburgh, New York, Riverside, San Bernardino, et cetera. In the case of Greenville and Spartanburg, the narrative that we heard from Greenville and sort of grudgingly as conceded from Spartanburg is that even during the textile heyday of 25 years ago and during the small manufacturing heyday before that, Greenville had always been a place with a lot of smaller companies, whereas Spartanburg was a place with one big company. The big company was the Millikan Company, which, you know, by Roger Millikan was a very dominant figure there. And so if you had – when you had an ecology where there were a lot of small, mutually competitive businesses, when it became clearer 25 or 30 years ago that the textile economy was going to go away, and it went away really fast, and NAFTA and the WTO had an effect – it was easier for the people of Greenville to say, we need to move to something else, as they have done with some regional industries there, that, you know, GE and BMW and Michelin and some others that are located between the cities but have more of their effect in Greenville. So it seemed to be something I know political scientists have studied. Since there was not one giant incumbent, it was easier to make a change than it seemed to have been for Spartanburg, which is now beginning its own adjustment process.
We're almost out of time, but I want to squeeze in one last question. The argument that social capital is diminishing in this country, the argument that Robert Putnam put forward years ago in his book Bowling Alone, Do you think that was off, given what you've now seen?
We all are the victims of what we've seen and what we know. What we have seen is that it's being rewoven and being reconstructed, and maybe in different ways from before, with different institutions. And the bowling leagues are not there, maybe as in Northern Ohio, but there. We were at a brew pub in Duluth last week, where in a side room, the Writers League of Lake Superior was having their having their meeting. Of course, you know, writers in a brewery, it makes sense, but there's a different kind of civic institutions that may be taking form. So. I think, you know, everything is simultaneously true in the U.S., but we're reporting on an important and under-noticed reweaving moment.
Well, with that, I think we're going to have to bring this to an end, although it's a conversation we could, I'm sure, have for hours. Thanks again. Our guest was James Fallows from The Atlantic, and James Fallows and Deborah Fallows are the authors of a new book, Our Towns, 100,000-mile journey into the heart of America from Pantheon, and it will be available everywhere. It is a really, really fantastic book, and I urge everyone to read it. And once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. So thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Goodbye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.